so good to be with you all tonight. Thank you for being here. This is a day that I've been looking forward to for quite some time. This is the second time that I've been to the Boston area. I know this is not Boston, it's Tingsboro, they're very different. But the second time I've been here, and the first time was back in 2006. I was a junior in college at the University of Arkansas, a young Razorback, and we came up here on a school trip for spring break. And we were here over a weekend, and so I had reached out ahead of time and made arrangements to come worship. And Wally and Sandy Hayes came into Boston and picked us up and brought us to worship. I was with a friend of mine, and that afternoon there was a gathering of some kind that you all had in their home. And the thing that stood out to me so much is just how welcoming you all were to us then. Just the two college kids that you'd never met before, but you welcomed us into your spiritual family, and we spent the afternoon with some of you, maybe many of you. And that has stuck with me ever since. And so I've been eager to come back and just to try in some small way to repay the kindness that you all showed to us almost 20 years ago. That doesn't sound right, but it's true. So thank you for being here. I'm excited about the weekend with you all, and excited to talk about this topic, breaking barriers. Really, the idea is that in our walk with the Lord, in our participation with God in His work, there are all kinds of barriers that we run into. There are things that happen in our lives individually. There are things that are happening in the world as a whole that can get in the way of us just letting God do His work in us and letting Him use us to do His work in the world. So we're going to talk about six things that I hope will be common things, things that will be easy to relate to, things that we all are challenged by at some level. And tonight I'm going to talk about one that I think will be one of the most familiar to all of us, and that is the barrier of uncertainty. Just to introduce this and to get us thinking about this idea, by the way, if you have your Bibles out, open them to Psalm 11. We're going to be in Psalm 11 for most of our time tonight. And I'm going to ask you, as you're turning in Psalm 11, just to think about this question. How do you feel about the current state of things in the world? Or of the current state of things in our nation? Of course, this is an election year, so we're going to find out in a few months how our nation feels about the state of the nation based on how we vote as a nation. Now, I don't know how you would answer that question, but the follow-up to it, I think, is a more important question. Regardless of how you feel about the state of things, how much do you feel like you can actually make a difference? I mean, regardless of whether you feel good about the way things are in our nation or you're nervous about things in our nation, how much do you personally feel like you can do to change that? You know, the reality is, because we're Americans, it is uncomfortable and honestly bothersome for us to be in a position where we have limited control. Because as Americans, we're taught that we have a say in things. We all get a vote. We all get to voice our opinion. We have freedom of speech. And so whenever we see things in the world around us that we don't like, our natural response is to say, well, I want to do something about it. Or I want to tell somebody what I think so that they can do something about it. But the truth for Christians is different. The truth for Christians is that being in a position where we have limited control shouldn't really upset us that much. Because as Christians, so much of our identity is rooted in this willingness to give up control of our lives, to give up our choices, ultimately to give them up to our King Jesus. But even in the practical day-to-day in our relationships with each other, so much of what should define us as Christians is a willingness to say, I'm going to set aside my preferences for what's better for my brother or my sister. And yet, how easy is it for us when things don't go our way to get frustrated about it? I'll be the first to raise my hand and say it is remarkable and kind of, if I'm being honest, embarrassing how much some little thing that happens in my day or in my schedule that's not what I wanted to happen or that's not what I planned. And it can frustrate me. It can get me bent out of shape. And if you don't believe me, talk to my wife and she'll tell you how easily sometimes I get frustrated about little things that at the end of the day don't really matter. So what do we do when we find ourselves in situations where things don't go the way that we want them to? In other words, in the way that we'll put this in biblical language from Psalm 11, when the foundations of our lives start to be tested, when the foundations are not just tested, but even destroyed. Psalm 11 is a great text to help us think through this, this idea of our response to uncertainty. And I want to begin just by getting into the text and reading the first three verses together. We'll talk about this after we read a little bit, but let's read together Psalm 11, beginning in verse 1. In the Lord I take refuge. How can you say to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? For behold, the wicked bend the bow. They make ready their arrow upon the string, to shoot in darkness at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? So in these first three verses here, what we have, if you're the kind of person that thinks in terms of like structure and outlines, I'm going to give you just a very brief outline of these first three verses. What we have in these verses are the circumstances of the writer, who's identified as David, the circumstances that David is going through at this moment that he writes a psalm, the counsel that he receives from his advisors based on the circumstances in that he finds himself in, the reasons for the counsel, and then David's response. So, circumstances, counsel, reasons for the counsel, and then David's response. Let's talk about those in a little bit more detail. What David is going through in this psalm, according to verse 2, is a situation where his life was in danger. It's described as a situation where the wicked are bending the bow. They're making their arrow ready upon the string to shoot at the upright in heart. So whatever was going on in David's life that prompted the writing of this psalm, I think it's very clear that this is a situation where David realized that at any moment his light could be extinguished. That whoever these enemies were, whoever these wicked people were, they had drawn their bows, their arrows, and they were ready to let them fly. And so that David was facing a situation where his life was in very serious danger. And so based on that, the counsel that he receives is flee as a bird to your mountain, verse 1. And David's question, of course, is, well, how can you say this to me? And we'll talk about why he says that. But the advice that he gets from the people around him, based on his life being in peril, is, David, you just need to get out of here. Live to fight another day, but you can't stay here. Now, the reasons that they give that are verse 3, this question that's asked in verse 3. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? I don't know what you think this means. I think there are a couple of different ways we can interpret this. Maybe what they're saying is, David, you are the foundation of our nation. You are our king. You're our rock. We look to you for everything. And so if our foundation is destroyed, what are we going to do? If your life is taken, then where does that leave us as a nation? Maybe what they're saying, though, is that, David, the foundations are already destroyed. Your life and everything around you and all of the stability and all the things that you've enjoyed and that we've enjoyed as a nation, those are gone. And because of that, your life is at risk. So what is there left for us to do but to get you out of here and to find you a place where you can be safe? But David, through all this, gives a response that shows tremendous faith. And his response is, in the Lord I take refuge. And that's going to be the focus of our lesson tonight, is David's response and what we can learn from his response for our lives today. Now, before we leave this, I want to go back to the idea of David's circumstances for a moment. This is not the kind of psalm that's biographical. In other words, it's not one of the psalms that tells us what was happening when David wrote it. But I want you to think for a moment about when this might have been written. A moment in David's life when his life is being threatened by wicked people. Some people think that this may have been in David's life when he was running from Saul.
you know, after David's been anointed, he knows he's going to be the next king. But Saul is threatening him, and he's trying to kill him, and he's chasing him all over the country. In fact, remember there are moments where David is so afraid that he actually leaves Israel and he goes to the Philistines. He goes to the city of Gath, the home of Goliath the giant that he killed. And he does that because, at least in that moment, he doesn't know where else to go. There's no safe place where he can find refuge from Saul. Some people think that it was in that moment, in one of those moments where he was in Gath or hiding in one of the caves, but running from Saul. Other people think that it was written during the time in David's life when he was running away from what happened to the priests. Remember when David was running, one time he goes and he seeks refuge from the priests in this city called Nob. And Saul finds out about it. The priests give him bread, they give him the sword of Goliath. And when Saul finds out, he's furious and he summons the priests. And the priest takes David's side. And so Saul calls basically a hit on all of the priests in Nob. But nobody will do it because everybody knows you don't take the life of a priest of the Lord. Everybody except one guy. Remember that guy? Doeg the Edomite. Wasn't even an Israelite. He was a foreigner that was in Saul's court. And so Doeg goes and massacres all of the priests in Nob except for one that survives. Some people think that David wrote this in the aftermath of that slaughter of the priests. It's also possible that David wrote this at the end of his life. Remember, later on, toward the end of his kingship, he faces challenges from two of his sons, Absalom and Adonijah, both of whom tried to usurp the throne and take it from him. But I actually think that it's good that we don't really know when this was written, because in some ways, that creates in this psalm a universal appeal. I want you to think about all of the reasons in our lives that people's foundations can be shaken. First of all, think about all the things that we kind of build our lives on. But think about the things in life that can cause a foundation to shake. Maybe it's that you lose a spouse. The spouse passes away, or maybe it's that a spouse leaves and there's divorce that comes into a family. Perhaps it's a diagnosis, some sort of debilitating illness that's going to be chronic and it's going to be with you for the rest of your life. Maybe it's not even your health. Maybe it's the health of one of your kids or your spouse. Could be the loss of a job, a career that you've poured years into, and now someone comes along from your company and they tell you that we no longer need your services. Maybe it's not anything personal, though. Maybe it's that you look at the nation or the world around you and you see just how seemingly things become more and more corrupt and wicked and immoral. Any of those things can cause us to feel like the foundations of our life are crumbling. And it could just be that you had a kind of a plan for your life. You know, a few years ago, you thought ahead and you thought, this is where I expect to be in 5 or 10 years. And as you look back on that plan, maybe your life looks nothing like you thought it would. So what do we do in those moments? And I think that David's answer of faith, his response of faith in the psalm, can help us have that same kind of faith when we go through situations where our foundations crumble. By the way, does that statement in verse 3, does that sound familiar to anybody? If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? You know, if you listen closely enough, you'll hear a lot of people talking like that. In our nation as a whole, I remember last election cycle, this is the kind of thing that I would hear a lot of. And not just among unbelievers, but Christians. If the foundations of our nation, if a certain official is elected, then what are we going to do? By the way, I'm not getting political here. I heard people say that about all of the candidates, both of the major candidates. It doesn't really matter. But the point is that this is a question that a lot of people ask. What are we going to do if our nation goes in this direction, or if we're led by this kind of person, whatever the case is? So this is an eminently practical psalm for us. What gave David hope was the spiritual perspective that we're going to read about here in the next few verses. One last thing I want to spend a little bit of time on is I want to notice in the counsel that David gave some potential responses when our foundations crumbled. What can we do, even if it's not necessarily the best thing? One thing that we can do is what his advisors counseled him to do. We can run away. Flee as a bird. A few years ago, I mentioned the last election. This is a couple elections ago. We lived in northern Minnesota. And whenever we would hear people talk about like worries or fears about certain candidates being elected, sometimes people would say things like, you know, if so-and-so is elected, I don't know what I'm going to do. I think I'm just going to move to Canada. And in northern Minnesota, it's like, you know, it's like going to New Hampshire. It's just across the road. So people were serious about it. And sometimes this is how we deal with problems, is instead of facing them with maturity and with faith, we just say, I'm not going to face it at all. I'm just going to run away from it. Act like it's not there. And that is a potential option for a child of God. Another option is something that goes along with this. They say, flee as a bird to your mountain. And I think in some ways what that can represent, another option that can represent, is maybe we don't run away from the problem. Maybe we don't ignore the problem. But what we do is we look for refuge somewhere other than God. We seek a mountain other than Him. And I don't think it's difficult for us to see some of the mountains that people can go to for refuge. You know, sometimes when people are going through a hard time at work, we seek refuge in our families, right? Or the opposite of that. Maybe things aren't going well at home, and so we pour ourselves into our job while we sort things out, or to get us through that difficult time. For other people, it might be recreation, it might be a hobby, it might be exercise. For some, it could be substances, addiction, alcohol, pornography. So there are a number of different places that people go, even God's people, for refuge when our foundations crumble. But then, of course, David's response is to trust God. In the Lord, I take refuge. Now, the rest of the psalm, what we're going to find out is that David knows some things about the character of God that enabled him to have this perspective. And that's what we're going to spend the rest of our time looking at here in the psalm. So we're going to talk about how David viewed God. So let's read verses 4 through 7. I want you to look for two things here. David thought about God's position, where he was. He saw that and thought about it. And he also thought about God's character. Those were the things that he understood about God that shaped his perspective. And the shaping of that perspective allowed him to have hope in moments when the foundations were crumbling. So, what were the things that David saw about God's position, God's character? Look for those things as we continue reading. Verse 4 of Psalm 11. The Lord is in His holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold, His eyelids test the sons of men. The Lord tests the righteous and the wicked. And the one who loves violence, his soul hates. Upon the wicked He will rain snares. Fire and brimstone and burning wind will be the portion of their cup. For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteousness. The upright will behold His face. So what David saw in these moments where his foundations were crumbling is he saw God in two places in the psalm. Do you notice that? The first place is in the temple. By the way, before I talk about this anymore, when God's people struggle to deal with uncertainty in our lives, so much of the time it comes down to one of two questions. It can either be a personal question. In other words, the uncertainty is because of some failure in my life. And in those moments, the question that so often gets asked on when you boil it down is, can God really fix me? Like, I've made a mess of things. You know, I look at what my life should be and what I should be, and I'm not there. Can God really fix me? Or if it's not personal and it's more of kind of a broad frustration or broad uncertainty, the question is, can God fix this? Can He fix the world? Can He fix, you know, all the stuff that's going on that's causing us to question or to feel unstable? And this first picture, I think, deals with the first question. Can God really fix me? What David saw was God in His holy temple. Now, when you think of this in a Jewish context, what do you think comes to mind as they thought of the Lord and His temple? Well, when you think of God and His temple, it was a picture of intercession. The temple was the place where God was present among His people. It's the place that He said His name was going to dwell. And so when His people looked to the temple, they could always be reminded that God is with us, that God cares about us, that He intercedes for us, that He's loyal to the covenant that He made with us. And so whenever He makes a promise, He's going to keep that promise. And so that's helpful for us too. If we wonder if God can really fix us, this picture of God in the temple is a picture that's intended to show us that God can intercede for us. And if there's sin in our lives, if there's something that's causing us to be shaken, God is in a place through Jesus Christ where that sin can be dealt with. God wants to be present with us. He wants to be loyal to His covenant even when we fail. And through Jesus Christ, it's possible. By the way, you notice, think about when David is writing this. David talking about the temple. This would have been said at a time before the temple was actually built, right? I mean, David wanted to build the temple, but he wasn't the one that was actually allowed to. He made provisions, and then Solomon, his son, built it. How remarkable is it that someone like David would see God in his temple when there was no temple? There was a tabernacle. But I think what David realized is that God being present in His temple wasn't about a physical tent. It wasn't about a building made of gold or something like that. But it was a reality that no matter where a building was or wasn't, God was with His people. He was hearing their cry. He was loyal to His covenant. And He was there to intercede and to be with them. So that was one place that David saw God. The other place in the text in verse 4 that he sees God is on His throne. The Lord is on His throne, and His eyes behold the sons of men. If the Lord being in the temple was a picture of intercession and God's presence and His loyalty to His covenant, then what do you suppose the picture of God on His throne represented? Power, right? Control. And this is an important concept that David could see, especially in moments where perhaps he wasn't on the throne yet, or he had to leave his throne. And in those moments, he realized that God was still on the throne. It didn't really matter who was on the physical throne, because God was there. This is a message that was bigger even than David. It was a message that God was trying to communicate all through the Old Testament to Israel. When you think back to the times of the Exodus and God delivering them through this series of 10 plagues, those 10 plagues weren't just about bailing Israel out of slavery. They were attacks on the Egyptian gods that were specifically designed to show Pharaoh and every Egyptian who was really on the throne. You might think that your Pharaoh is God. You might think that he's the one in power and in control, but I'm here to show you that he doesn't have anything on me. Fast forward to the days of captivity in Babylon, in the days of Daniel. And so much of the book of Daniel, what God is doing in that book, is He's giving pictures that are designed to show the Jews in exile that even though Nebuchadnezzar or Darius or Cyrus, it didn't matter who was on the throne, God was really the one that was in power. In fact, the book starts with God telling the reason that Nebuchadnezzar came and took away captives is because God let him do it. God wanted him to. Or even in the New Testament, the book of Revelation, how many of those visions that John has are designed to show Christians living in a time where when you looked at the throne, you saw Caesar. And depending on when you lived, you might have seen a Caesar who was trying to take people like you and put them in his garden, pour oil on them and light them on fire as human torches. That's who was on the throne. That's who had control. And so many of those pictures in Revelation, I think, are God's way of showing those Christians that Caesar's not the power. He might be sitting on a throne, but I'm here to show you who really is in control of things. Those were the places that God saw David, in his temple and on his throne. And what's so valuable about that is that they remind us that it doesn't matter who is in power and how powerful they might seem and how opposed they are to God. God has a way of, in a very short time, being able to turn the tables. Now, let's talk about the second part of this, the character of God that David saw. The first thing that David points out is that God sees. Verse 4, David points out that his eyes behold, his eyelids test the sons of men. When you compare that to how David describes the enemy back in verse 2, this is really impressive. Because the enemy in verse 2, it's not just that they're drawing their bows and they're ready to let them fly. It's, do you notice when they're getting ready to shoot? In darkness. Why would somebody do that? You know, if somebody's going to pull an arrow and shoot it in somebody's stomach, take their life, why in darkness? Why does anybody do anything in darkness? It's because they don't want other people to know what they're doing. And so here's this picture of David. David looks at himself and he sees himself surrounded by all of these enemies. And the lights are off. Nobody knows what's about to happen. But David has conviction here that God knows. As dark as it may be, as much as his enemies try to keep anybody else from seeing this, God sees. His eyes behold, verse 4, his eyelids test the sons of men. That's the first thing that David realizes about God's character, is that God's not blind to the injustice and the evil going on around him. The second thing that he sees is that God acts. And this is one of my favorite things about this psalm. When God acts, he doesn't just jump in at David's side and defend him. He doesn't just disarm all of the archers who have their bows and arrows pointed at David. But do you see in verse 6 what God's going to do? Upon the wicked, he will rain snares. Fire and brimstone and burning wind will be the portion of their cup. I want to try to paint a picture of this. Imagine David again in the middle of this mob of enemies, all of them with their arrows drawn, ready to shoot David to take his life. And at the last moment when they're about to let the arrows fly, God calls in the artillery from on high. Fire and brimstone come from above, and they just take everybody out, and the righteous sufferer is left in the middle. That's how David thought about this. So really what David thinks about is, or what David pictured, is that it wasn't just that God was going to show up and there's going to be a battle and, you know, God's going to fight, but he's going to win at the end. There was no battle at all. This was, in David's mind, the greatest mismatch in all of history. I don't know what you think of when you think of mismatches, but there's one thing that comes to my mind more than anything else. It happened when I was a little boy. I grew up in Arkansas, and I remember one time my younger brother had gotten in trouble with my dad. I don't know what he had done, but something, for some reason, he was in trouble with my dad. My dad was sitting in our bedroom talking with him, you know, like trying to kind of reason with him. And for some reason, I walked back there. I wanted to kind of see what was going on. You know how older brothers are. They want to, like, see when their younger brothers are in trouble. So I walked back there, and I remember, you know, like seeing this scene. My dad was, you can try to picture this. My dad was sitting on our bed looking at my brother. My brother's facing him. And my little brother, I don't know, he's probably 3 years old, was standing up facing my dad. And about the time that they came into view and I got to where I could see what was going on, my younger brother, for some unexplained reason, I have no idea why he thought this was a good idea, but he does this to my dad. Like, he holds his fist up like he's going to fight my dad. And it was the funniest. What happened after that is, like, burned into my mind. It's the funniest thing I've ever seen. It's, he hadn't even locked his fist before my dad, in like one motion, had reached out and grabbed him by the wrist and then bent him over his lap and just started spanking. I mean, it was, you know, and I just thought it was hilarious. So, so I turned around and went to go tell my other brother what was happening. But when you talk about a mismatch, I mean, that's kind of what I think of. Like this little nerdy 3-year-old kid that thinks he can take a grown man.
and there is no chance. And when David saw the foundations of his life being shaken, he didn't worry about it because he understood that God saw and that God acted.
By the way, there's one more thing that David says that I think is really perceptive and helpful. Because David understood that about God, notice verse 5. The Lord tests the righteous and the wicked. I think because David understood that God was in his temple and he was on his throne and he saw and he acted, what that enabled David to do is whenever he went through a moment where everybody else was saying, David, you got to go. Foundations are gone, man. What David was able to do is he was able to see this for what it was. It was a test of the righteous. God wasn't just testing the wicked for their faithfulness or for their response, but he was also testing the righteous. And so David was able to, in that moment, to understand that all that he needed to do and focus on is not worry about the wicked, not worry about the foundations around him, but to simply trust in God and to focus on his response. And I believe in our lives, when our foundations crumble around us, if we remember this about God, if we remember who God is and how he works and where he is, those things will just be tests for us. And when everybody else in the world has their world fall apart and their foundations crumble, God's people will be able to look at that and say, you know what, this is just, it's just a test. And what I know about God is what he says in verse 7. He's righteous and he loves righteousness. And so if I want to behold his face, then what that means for me is I need to be upright. And I can't control anything else going on around me, but I can control my response. Just for a couple minutes, I want to take you to a couple of New Testament texts that speak to this idea. One of them is something that Paul tells the young preacher Timothy in 2 Timothy 2, verse 19. I'm going to back up actually and read a little bit of the context of this. If you want to follow along, 2 Timothy 2, I'm going to begin reading in verse 14. 2 Timothy 2, verse 14. Paul says, remind them of these things, and solemnly charge them in the presence of God not to wrangle about words, which is useless and leads to the ruin of the hearers. Be diligent to present yourself approved to God as a workman who does not need to be ashamed, accurately handling the word of truth. But avoid worldly and empty chatter, for it will lead to further ungodliness, and their talk will spread like gangrene. Among them are Hymenaeus and Philetus, men who have gone astray from the truth, saying that the resurrection has already taken place, and they upset the faith of some. Nevertheless, verse 19, the firm foundation of God stands, having this seal, the Lord knows those who are his, and everyone who names the name of the Lord is to abstain from wickedness. I think in these verses we see another common response from people of the world when foundations crumble. And not just people of the world, but sometimes even Christians. Paul says, don't be like these people who just wrangle about words. And sometimes when we go through hard times or when things around us are uncomfortable for us as Christians, if you listen closely enough, that's the kind of language that starts to happen, the conversations that people have, is just wrangling about words. And arguing about stuff that at the end of the day has no value whatsoever for the salvation of the soul. And so what Paul wants Timothy to understand in those moments is understand the foundation of God. He knows who belongs to him. So no matter what everybody else around you is talking about, don't get caught up in that. Christian, it doesn't matter what people are saying on Facebook or TikTok or Instagram or whatever social media you want to choose. Don't worry about that stuff. At the end of the day, if we want to name the name of the Lord, we want to be his people, then while everybody else is talking about different things in the world and wrangling about fruitless discussions, our response is just to stay away from it, to abstain from wickedness. Jesus talked about this too. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount, remember in Matthew 7, verse 24, at the end of this illustration about two builders. He talks about one that builds on the sand and one that builds on the rock. And he says, therefore, in verse 24 of chapter 7, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock. The thing I want you to think about tonight is in both of those cases, both builders, both of them heard the words of God. Matthew 7, Jesus says, regardless of the builder and the foundation, both of them hear the words of God. The difference is, the one who builds on the rock listens. And he acts on the words of God. It's great that we are here tonight and we're talking about the Word of God, but it's not enough, you know? Like, if we just go home tonight and we put our Bibles away and we get up the next morning and we just kind of go back to living the way that the world lives, all of the teaching in the world won't do us any good. So this is a reminder to us that if we want firm foundations, if we want the kind of foundations that are going to stand when everybody else's are crumbling, that's only going to come when we listen to what God says and we act on it. So that's the message for tonight. We can have the kinds of foundations that last. And when things in our life get difficult, we don't have to be shaken by that. If we learn the lessons of David from the Psalm. I really appreciate your good attention tonight. Thank you. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll meet back together.